From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today is the day Americans set aside to consider the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, and that's what we're doing on our show. Later this hour, we'll have a multi-generational conversation with people active in the fight for civil rights from the time of King to Black Lives Matter. And we're beginning our show with a conversation on an often overlooked corner of the civil rights movement right here in Illinois. Before we get to that, however, we want to set up that conversation by hearing just a little bit from Dr. King himself. On February 10, 1966, King gave a speech at Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington. In it, he talked about the concept of time and how some in America were saying that time was the only cure for integration and racial injustice. King said, "Just be nice and just be patient and wait 100 or 200 years and the problem will work itself out." But that is a myth, he said, because, quote, "time is neutral and it can be used either constructively or destructively."
And I'm absolutely convinced that in so many instances, the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme righteous of our nation, have used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people who will bomb a church in Birmingham, Alabama, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, "Wait on time." Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. And so it is necessary to help time and to realize that the time is always ripe to do right.
The time is always right to do right, Dr. King said in Bloomington. And if the time is always right, it stands to reason that the place is always right to do right. Now, when we think of the civil rights movement in America, for most of us, the places that first come to mind are Selma, Little Rock, Montgomery. But the fight for equal justice came to countless towns and cities across the country, many overlooked in popular history. Among those is Cairo, Illinois, at the southern tip of the state, seated at the crossroads of the Mississippi and the Ohio Rivers. Cairo is considered by some to be at the center of the civil rights movement in the heartland. The NAACP saw it as a place to test out legal direct actions, and then in the 1960s, there was a Black Power movement in response to white violence against people of color. We're joined now by Robbie Cohen, a resident of Cairo and the daughter of the late Cairo civil rights leader, Reverend Charles Cohen. Robbie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. I appreciate your asking me.
I'd also like to welcome Professor Carrie Pimblott. She's the author of the history book, Faith in Black Power, Religion, Race, and Resistance in Cairo, Illinois. She began researching Cairo while a graduate student at the University of Illinois. She's currently a lecturer in the Department of International History at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom. Carrie, thank you for joining us as well.
Greetings, and thank you for having me on.
Robbie, I want to begin with you. You were born in the 60s in Cairo and still live there today. Can you tell us about the events of 1969? I understand that was a pivotal year.
Yes, it was. Again, I want to say good morning to everyone on this definitely momentous day of Dr. King's, of the commemoration of Dr. King's birthday. And I also want to thank you all for asking me. Yes, to be specific, I was born in 1964, and in 1969, that's when the United Front was born, and actually the United Front was started by my father, the Reverend Dr. Charles Cohen, and several other very devoted and committed members of the Cairo community, such as Switch Wilson, Herney Mallory, Johnny Posey, several other members of the Cairo community that it would take me too long to list all of their names, that came together to start the United Front in order to address the spiritual, the physical, and the economic injustices that particularly Black people in Cairo were experiencing, but also poor people in Cairo were experiencing, because anyone who has any knowledge of the struggle that went on during that time, while yes, the vast masses of those who were involved in the struggle were Black, there were many others who were involved in the struggle with us that were also white.
What was it about 1969 in particular? Was there some sort of catalyzing event that year, or was this something that had just been building over time?
Yeah. Actually, in the earlier 60s, my dad and several other youth at the time started working with SNCC to actually integrate the local accommodations around here, i.e. restaurants, bowling alleys.
There's a swimming pool, I understand. Famously, John Lewis was involved in that
fight. Exactly, exactly. And it was through the work of SNCC, working with an area church here, which was Ward Chapel AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal Church, which at that time happened to be the church home of my dad, as well as his family, the Bondurant family. But actually, shortly thereafter, there was a young GI that had been found hung in the police department here. And as a result of that, you know, the community was, of course, very upset and galvanized at that point to not only deal with, you know, the issues of integrating the accommodations and the establishments, but also looking at all of the racial injustices the Blacks were facing, you know, and of course, adding to that, you know, police brutality and death at the hands of police. Because even though the police, of course, said that he had hung himself, many people knew that that was not the case. But also what ended up happening specifically in 1969 was that an area organization called the White Hats began to shoot into our community, which was the housing projects here called Pyramid Courts. That happened for 169 consecutive nights. And while, yes, I was a witness and participant to some of these things, I definitely was a witness to them shooting into our homes. And, you know, I think about the quote that Maya Angelou states about people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And that is a memory that sticks with me to this day, because of course I felt insecure, I felt angry, I felt upset, I felt sad, I felt afraid. There are many vestiges, or I should say residuals in my life of things that happen as a result of that shooting into our homes. I mean, and one thing that always comes up, and it may seem minute to others, but it was very consequential to me. My grandmother literally left this town. My maternal grandmother left this town because at the time, many persons slept in their bathtubs or slept on the floor. And my great grandmother slept in the bathtub. And one night, a bullet came into the house and it fell in the bathtub. So at that point, that was my maternal grandmother's, you know, just last stand with Cairo. And she left here based upon that and was gone for many years. I think that was early 70s. She didn't return here until like maybe the late 70s. So that struggle came out of not only, you know, racial injustice, economic injustice, but when people start shooting into your home, I mean, make no mistake about it. I understand that they were shooting to kill us. They weren't shooting in the air. They meant to do what they were doing. And the only reason I feel that they didn't just come in, kick in our doors and shoot us on the spot was because members of the United Front realized that they were going to have to shoot back. So again, that was one of the main galvanizing forces, because it came to a point where it was either life or death, your life or your death.
Sure. Carrie Pimblot, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Can you talk about how Cairo's geographic location contributed to its role in the civil rights movement and later the Black Power movement there?
Absolutely. There's some really unique features of Cairo as a community that I explore in the larger book. And one of the central ones is that I position it within a region that the scholar Henry Louis Taylor Jr. describes as the borderland, which is it is a place that's located interstitially between the north and the south and has characteristics of both places. And so it's in Illinois, but it is supposed to abide by the laws of the state of Illinois, which at this point ban things like segregation in public accommodations. But its culture and its practices were much more akin to the Deep South. And so people in the community would often refer to it in civil rights organizations as Little Mississippi. And the culture of that community had been one where, as you can tell from Robbie's comments, a very strong culture of organized white nationalism, white supremacy was present in groups like the John Birch Society, the Klan, and then the White Citizens Council in that period. And also the actual structure of racial oppression that people faced, people of African descent, in the city was very rigid. And this is not to diminish the experiences of people living in other parts of the state, but to indicate that in Cairo, segregation was total in terms of people's way of life in the earlier 20th century. And that people like Reverend Cohen grew up under a very tight system of segregation in public accommodations, in all areas of their lived experience. And this was something that shaped the lived experiences of all people of African descent and white descendants in that community too, for their lives. And so the struggle for civil rights and Black power really took shape against that backdrop.
And you mentioned sort of the de facto segregation there. There was a long history of racial violence, as we heard about from Robbie. I understand this was also a place where the NAACP sort of ran some test cases there. Can you talk about its focus on Cairo?
Yeah, and this is actually something that's a tendency of the NAACP across the borderland. You'll probably be familiar with the fact that many of the early test cases for things like desegregation of schools, the salary equalization suits for teachers in housing, all of the early cases took place in borderland communities, because what those states had often, or those communities had, was often a kind of conflict between local practice and state law, or for the NAACP, they felt sometimes this would be a safer place to test kind of cases for integration, because the culture was imagined to be less kind of committed to the types of rigid segregation as the Deep South. Now, in Cairo, that turned out not to be the case. There was certainly an opportunity to test the laws that exist in the state that were banning segregation. And so they did try. And what you've just heard from Robbie, which I think is just an amazing account of Reverend Dr. Cohen's early struggles in the city, was test cases for the NAACP first in the realm of public accommodation, specifically schooling to integrate local schools. And then secondly, the sit-in movement, where the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Nashville leadership led by John Lewis, came to Cairo and chose to organize in solidarity with the local school children there and local ministers to try to integrate public accommodations there. So the fact that civil rights organizations viewed Cairo as a test case is very much to do with these kind of contradictory relationships between the law of the state and the practices at the local level.
And I want to go back now to Robbie, because I should say we need to take a break here in about a minute. But your father was a reverend, as we've been hearing, and a founding organizer of the Black Power movement in Cairo. Can you talk about how central was the church in his life and to his work on civil rights?
Absolutely. Just right quick before I get to that, I do want to make a reference to the fact that one of the very involved persons in that movement of desegregation of the schools was Miss Hattie B. Kendrick. And thankfully I lived long enough to be a actual friend of hers. Thurgood Marshall through the NAACP did come down, and she was one of the teachers who was very involved in that desegregation movement in the schools that Carrie just spoke of. But going right back to what you just said very quickly, God definitely was the author of the history of our struggle. The United Front, which my dad started with others, the actual place that that housed the United Front was a church that had been given to the United Front by the Catholic diocese. It just so happened to, unfortunately, have been described as a Black Catholic church. It was the church where Blacks went to. It was also the school that they had that was associated with that Catholic church was also considered to be the Black Catholic school. But that particular setting was the spiritual setting where on Saturdays we had our rallies. Those rallies provided the spiritual sustenance as well as the strategic planning sustenance for the movement. Most people came to those rallies. And I should say, when I say most people, most of the Black citizens came to those rallies on Saturdays. There they received a word from God. There they received strategic plans for how the movement was going to go forward the next week or the next month.
And we're going to hear more about that and how that might have been different in Carroll than it was in other cities with our guests. They are Robbie Cohen and Carrie Pimblatt. We're talking about the civil rights movement in Carroll, Illinois. It's going to continue after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today is Martin Luther King Day. We're setting aside our entire program to talk about civil rights in Illinois. Later, we're going to be having an intergenerational conversation of people who have been active in the movement, or at least were alive in the, during the movement in the 1960s through the present generation of activists for Black Lives Matter. But first, though, we're talking about Carroll, Illinois, at the southernmost part of the state, at the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. It's a town, as we've been hearing, that was sort of in the north, but also of the south. And we're speaking with Robbie Cohen, who's a daughter of the Reverend Charles Cohen, who was a lifelong Carroll resident and the leader of the United Front, which was a civil rights group founded in response to a long history of segregation, as well as some terrible incidents of violence where you're hearing about in the late 1960s. We're also speaking with Carrie Pimblatt, who is a professor at the University of Manchester in international history. That's in the United Kingdom. She researched Carroll while a graduate student at the University of Illinois. Her book is Faith in Black Power, Religion, Race, and Resistance in Carroll, Illinois. And Carrie, I want to ask about that, about faith in particular. We were just hearing before the break about Robbie's father and the importance of religion and to the movement for him. Can you talk about the religious dynamics in Carroll and how that might have differed from other cities like Chicago or Detroit in terms of the civil rights movement?
I think there's often a common perception of the Black Power movement that's rooted in popular and scholarly discourses that the movement is a secular one. And that's something that really strikes you when you listen to Robbie's comments there about her father's rootedness within kind of Black Christian traditions, you know, the importance of that to this movement, really single Cairo out in the public mind during this period as a unique place. And I think some of the reason for that surprise is that the way we often think about civil rights and Black Power is that the civil rights movement is rooted in these Southern struggles, and the Black Power movement was largely a Northern urban phenomenon. And so our notions of the religious sensibilities of those movements have been informed by that kind of regional understanding. But in reality, you know, the story is much more complex than that. And Cairo really provides us with a window to understand some of the religious dynamics of Black Power, the complexity of Black Power. So in Cairo, as Robbie suggested, you know, Black Christian tradition stood at the absolute heart of this movement. And what made Reverend Cohen, for me, such an interesting person, such an important figure, was the way in which he blended kind of the latest in Black liberation theology that was coming out of kind of theological traditions at the time. And he was blending them with Black Power activism on the ground. And it created, and this is a really important day to discuss this, I think, a connectedness between earlier civil rights phases of the movement, which had, everybody knew had been rooted in kind of church-based traditions, and the Black Power movement. And it was unusual compared to some other places in the North, as you suggest. Not everywhere in the North were people going to be so outspoken in their kind of blending of these Christian discourses with Black Power advocacy around armed self-defense, around Black self-determination, those kinds of discourses. And so it struck a different tone. And Cohen certainly was an advocate for this type of philosophy as a basis for building effective social movements at a local level. And I'll say, for me, this is one of the things that really stood out about the local movement and made it so effective in Cairo, where the vast majority of people living within the community were regular church attendees, attending, as Robbie suggested, the AME congregation or Baptist congregations there. So it was something that set Cairo kind of apart and made it bring together a continuity between civil rights and Black Power struggles.
We need to end this conversation, but Robbie, I want to ask about that sort of fusion of what we were just hearing about from Kerry, the sort of the church-based civil rights movement, the Northern Black Power movement, and how that relates to today. Our next conversation is going to be sort of bridging the civil rights era and the Black Lives Matter era. I wonder if you have a perspective on what your father might have thought of today's movement for racial justice. I should mention he passed away in 2018.
Yes, he did pass away in 2018. And of course, that's something that we live with daily, but we also live with his spirit, which he taught us, particularly his children, about universal spirituality and the fact that the legacy that you leave and the life that you live provides you the ability to live on, actually. And so he does through the works that he lived. I do want to say and definitely give kudos to Kerry, because she specifically and very accurately depicted exactly what happened. God was at the very center of our struggle. There are two scriptures that were the focus of the United Front. One was Nehemiah 4:17, where it talked about when the Jews returned to Israel, they worked with one hand doing the work on the wall and the other hand was on their weapon. The other scriptural reference was Matthew 25. Consistently, it was taught that we were to look out for those who were hungry, those who were unclothed, those who were sick, those who were imprisoned, those who were shut in. So that was the basis upon which the United Front was built. And right before the break, what I wanted to also state was that those rallies, every Saturday, people were fed and people were clothed, and that was all a part of the mission. How would you feel about the movement that we see happening right now? I think we'll be absolutely proud of our people who have made, and when I say our people, I'm not just talking about Black people, I'm talking about humanity. Because one thing for sure was that my dad had a respect for all humanity. And that's why he was so vehemently against racism, so vehemently against any degradation, whether that was from someone that was white or from someone that was Black. But I think he would be so proud of the movement that exists right now. Number one, because of the commitment of the people in the movement, because of their respect for themselves and their respect for one another, and because of their allegiance to not stopping until they achieve what we have decided all together the goal should be. And that's one thing, when you look at my dad's life, what resonated from when he was 16 to when he left this earth at 72 was that he was committed to see God's kingdom become a reality here on earth. And that is rooting out all of the vestiges of slavery, because racism is really a vestige of slavery, rooting out economic injustice, which also goes back to slavery, rooting out oppression, however it rears its ugly head, whether that's oppression that we decide that whites decide to put on Blacks or that Blacks decide to put on one another, but just really understanding that we can only realize God's kingdom on earth, when we make a commitment to realize who God is and to live according to his word and to live courageously, because we can get all of the education that we want and we can go to all the churches that we want to go to. But unless we find courage in God to stand and find courage in God to have something to be willing to die for, then we will remain in mental bondage, mental slavery. And that's something that my dad fought against all of his life.
I think that's a great spot on which to end our conversation. Robbie Cohen is a resident of Cairo and the daughter of the late Cairo civil rights leader, the Reverend Charles Cohen. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We've also been speaking with Professor Carrie Pimblot. She is a lecturer in the Department of International History at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom and the author of Faith in Black Power, Religion, Race, and Resistance in Cairo, Illinois. Carrie Pimblot, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you.